Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
It's harder to focus than ever these days. Thankfully, C4 has reinvented the energy drink game with C4 Smart Energy, the only energy drink clinically proven to provide enhanced mental focus, containing 200 milligrams of natural caffeine, a blend of vitamins and zero sugar. It was formulated to support your well-being and help you feel your best, all while enhancing mental focus. From your brain to your body, C4 Smart Energy does it all. And tastes amazing. Look for Smart Energy in the beverage aisle at your local Kroger, Albertsons, and Safeway grocery stores. C4 Smart Energy. Stay focused.
Welcome to this podcast number 601. I will be performing in San Francisco December 11th, 12th, and 13th at Cobb's. Go to Cobb's website. I think it's cobbscomedyclub.com, maybe? Or just Google Chris Hardwick Cobb's and it'll come up. I probably should have had this information handy before I started recording the intro, Katie. I apologize. I'm a very bad host. I apologize. Very sorry. This episode is Adam Savage, who is promoting a dear old friend of mine. I don't mean he's old, but we've been friends for a long time. He is a friend.
He's
and not an old friend
point.
And like, oh, it's a friend who's it's soured. It's an old friendship. No, we've been friends for a long time. And he's promoting Mythbusters Behind the Myth Tour, which starts today. Dates and tickets are on MythbustersTour.com. Adam and Jamie are on the road. Doing a bunch of stuff, and he talks about it in this podcast. Always a delightful guest. It's Nerds Podcast number 601. Adam Savage returns!
Nom, 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 nom.
They're really good.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
What do you do in Los Angeles?
You know, pitching shit, eating well.
Nice.
What's going on? What else is there to do in Los Angeles?
I think just those two things.
Yeah. I did Thrilling Adventure Hour on Saturday night.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Good.
I love the Bends.
The Bends are great and the show's amazing. Who else was on?
Bradley Whitford, Josh Molina. It was a fun crowd.
Good.
Yeah.
It's kind of a West Wing crowd.
I know. And I just started watching Sports Night again.
Oh, nice. How do you have time to watch shows you've already seen?
It's on Hulu, so I can do it wherever I am.
Oh, wherever you are. I posted a couple things on Instagram that you were responsible for. Number one, the Time Bandits map, which I've had
framed.
Oh,
yes, I saw that. I think I retweeted that.
Yes, so it's been framed. I don't have it in my house yet, but I'm getting it back soon. Which will allow me to go back in time and rob famous historical
John
figures.
Cleese.
John Cleese or Ian Holm as Napoleon. And then also that picture that I took in your office with the Akbar mask.
You called it the vagina magnet. Akbar mask, Hellboy coat, Blade Runner gun, and
noisy
Men
cricket.
In Black noisy cricket.
Yep. Yep, it was great.
Phenomenal.
It was such a good... I've been holding on to those for a while, and I'm like, oh, I finally got to post these. you made the Deckard gun, right?
The one you were holding, yes. That's the one I built from scratch.
Oh, man. Is that the final one?
It's not quite done.
Is it ever done?
Nothing's ever...
It's never done.
No, there's always like something perfect that I need to do. I bought some more parts to it to redo a couple things I over-machined.
Oh, man. But now you actually have, like, the machine shop is in fully working.
It's in full bloom, although my lease is up soon. But the shop is really, really nicely appointed now.
I remember when this shop was born. Was this because of Guillermo, or was this around, or was
no,
it just coincidentally?
It happened sort of concurrently. You mean, like, yeah, because when I met Guillermo at Comic-Con, whatever now, 5 years ago, he said, come to my man cave. And
right.
I was like... I was just putting the shop together at that point, and I hadn't thought of calling it anything. But Julia, my wife, was like, you should get a shop near the house because it's the Mission District in San Francisco and we can find an industrial space. And yeah. You should have half of it be for display and having meetings and hanging out. And the other half is the shop. And it just worked out beautifully.
And then you started getting all these insane pieces of machinery, the industrial...
I've had to have... Some were so large, I had to have them removed.
Oh, really?
I think the last time you were there, there was a giant milling machine there,
yes.
which I actually gave to a school.
Oh, yeah.
It's just too big. I never got around to touching it. It weighs like 7,000 pounds.
How do you get it in and out of there?
You actually have to hire guys with a flatbed, and you have to move the pool table...
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to put it back and level it, which costs a few $100s
yes.
every time you touch
every
it.
Every time. So it's not free to get stuff in and out of there.
No.
And then...
we're going, though. Is that what's happening? Are we just rolling?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Cool.
Yeah, yeah. I've really enjoyed the show that you've been doing, like just the made show, like the make it, you're just making stuff.
And we're trying every different aspect of it that we can. I mean, like... Tested.com is such an incubator that it's like, oh, well, let's try building this. Let's try building that. And let's see how that goes. And there's no, you know this, you have no idea what's going to hit and get tons and tons of comments
right.
and response. Like, I know the guys at Prop Store of London, and they gave me a deal on the set of samurai armor from 47 Ronin because the movie tanked.
Right.
And we just decided, oh, let's do an unboxing. Just like massive amounts of hits. People went nuts for it. So we're going to start doing a mailbag special. So why not?
People like unboxing, even if it was for a movie that they didn't see.
I didn't realize that it was huge with children. Do you know about this?
No.
Children love going online and watching their favorite toys be unboxed to music. And there are videos, hundreds of them, that have millions and millions and millions of hits. And it's kids transfixed watching Fisher-Price toys get unboxed.
Oh, I've been doing it wrong.
I know. It's like, I don't know anything.
Nerdist website should just be all people opening toys.
But tell me if you end up with this. I end up going into my shop on the weekends if I have time. Like, we finished shooting Mythbusters for the year about 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to spend some time in my shop. But I feel guilty if I'm not filming it or taking photos of what I'm building.
Right.
I actually am like, this is content. I'm wasting content. At
yes.
the same time, I'm like, I got to just do some shit for myself and move forward with it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I find that too, that if someone's going to come on the podcast and they're like, let's grab coffee. I'm like, let's do it after the podcast because we'll probably blow through everything that we would have talked about
yes.
on the podcast, like all the catching up stuff.
Yeah, the meal before is never a good idea. It's never a good idea.
But then afterwards, you just stare at each other.
Yeah.
We already talked about everything. I don't know what to say. I don't know what
But Tested, say. Norman will have been so much fun to work with on Tested. Like, they're so game to try anything and to give structure to anything. It's like, we've just been having so much fun.
Yeah. And do you have, is it all planned in advance or do you just go, oh, you know, today I kind of just feel like doing this, so let's just do this.
There's a little bit of both. There's a little bit of both. You know, we try and record the podcast every week, still Untitled Project, which means, you know, I'm about to go on tour for 5 weeks. So
Mythbusters tour?
The Behind the Myths tour coming to Los Angeles. You're going to get an email from me. I got some comps for you.
What?
Well, we're never going to sell out the Nokia.
That's
like 6,500 seats.
That's a lot of seats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and they can block off sections so it doesn't look totally Ma and Pa Kettle in there. But on December 17th, we're coming through LA. That's the penultimate performance.
Mm-hmm.
So the show should be in fine form by then.
Good.
We're doing 26 cities in 29 days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. So you and Jamie are sharing a room. Right?
No, we have total rock star. We have buses. And the buses sleep six crew members on each bus in bunks. And in the back of each bus, there's a suite, one for me and one for Jamie.
And then one for beret storage.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's the front of Jamie's bus.
Right. Which also has a mustache on the front of the bus. That's how you know it's Jamie's.
That last time we went, Jamie's bus was jet black. But my bus seriously had a tramp stamp on it.
Really?
It had a filigree design on the back that it was a classic tramp stamp. And it was on the rear end, too.
Did his bus try to fuck your bus?
I don't know what happens while we're working during the day.
The buses do what the buses do. You can't tell.
It is very funny, though. The touring, you've done so much more of this than I have. But I found that you can totally get calcified just moving from city to city and never wanting to leave your hotel room.
Oh, yeah, it's hard. It's because you expend so much energy at the shows at night, and all the things you think you're going to do during the day don't happen because you just get tired. You get tired.
Yeah, and then you get wired, too, also. Performing for, like, I find our show ends at 10 p.m. I'm never asleep before 2.
No, it's impossible. You can't come home and then just immediately relax. I mean, it's not surprising that so many performers drink or do drugs because it's like some people just need to shave the edge off that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's a good way to do it, but I understand why that process happens, but it is weird to, you know, you're just like, yeah. Is Julie on the coming on the tour with you at all?
She does. We've been finding the right level. So we went to Australia, New Zealand this summer. We did shows in Sydney, Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Auckland.
Wow.
And she came on that entire trip, and that was awesome. Because Australia is so big, it's like performing one day in New York and the next day and 4 days later in St. Petersburg.
Right.
So you fly, and then there's like 3 days while you wait for the bus to show up.
Right.
So we had lots of time to sightsee and everything, and I brought the boys out for 2 weeks of that. Nice. It was great. On this trip, I'm going out alone for the first week. She's going to meet me on Thanksgiving up in Montreal with the kids.
Yeah, nice.
And then we're going to tool around the East Coast for a while, and then I think I'm not going to see her again until I come back through L.A.
See, I think you should have a couple days where she pretends that she's a groupie, and then you're like, want to see the bus?
No, that's the whole thing, is I go, send me a girl. Hi, baby.
You're the perfect one.
Exactly. The first time we toured, I never left the bus, and I never left the hotel rooms, and it just felt really dark, and this last time we toured, the last time we did the heavy-duty tour, which was last November, December, I forced myself to get out every day and take a photo of something and blog about it. And wow. It was hard work. It was like I so didn't want to do it sometimes. And I would get 3 or 4 days behind. But I remember the trip really fondly. And now that's my thinking, is get out every day and do something.
Yeah, it's really hard to get motivated to do that. And then also it's easy to get forgiving with yourself. You're like, well, I got a show tonight. I got to run. I got to rest up. But for me, it's sort of the day parts when I'm on tour are just like kind of micro vacations in the sense where I go, well, I'm here to work at night, and so I'm just going to rest today because that's going to be – and so I actually – that's where I kind of cram in some resting.
Yeah, it's true. It's interesting to find the balance. Like I said, that calcification can get so dark.
Yeah, and I don't – it's not like I just sit and watch movies all day. It's usually just on the computer.
Yeah, you're writing and you're surfing. Day.
And then all of a sudden,
what's going on at Jezebel?
You haven't turned the lights on at all, and all of a sudden it's just dark.
Yeah, totally.
It's like 6 p.m. and just like the glow of the screen, and you're like, I guess I better shower. I have to go do a show. It can get weird, but I've never done the bus. I've always wanted to do the bus tour, but I haven't done that. I haven't done it yet because it just, schedule-wise, I just have to pop back and forth all the time.
Right.
So
it's really fun to do it that way. It's nice to – it gives me personally, who does not – I mean, I know that you work so hard to hone your material, you know, crowd to crowd and night to night and sort of refining it. And for me, this show is very similar from night to night, but I also – having written it, I find myself wanting everything to be good. So I'll hone in on a piece that's, you know, the transition between this part and that part isn't perfect. And doing the show 6 nights a week feels awesome in terms of being able to see the reaction. Like, I've really learned that you can make an audience laugh one night, but it takes real crafting to get a joke that hits every night.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is just playing. I mean, it's just trial and error. It's just playing with it. It's just, that's your machine shop. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just, it's Deckard's gun. You're just over and over and over, and it may never be fully perfect, but at a certain point, it's like.
There's this one joke that kicks my ass. I just know there's a laugh in there, and I can't find it. I know there's a better laugh than the one I'm getting, and I can't find it, and I try it a different wording every night, probably 70 times, and I have not yet found what I think is. It has to do with shark diving, going diving with sharks, and we had to wear this stainless steel shark. Oh yeah, work with this one. Work with me on this. So the story is, we're going down to the Bahamas, and we're going to be diving with sharks, and the shark safety guys were telling us, when you come down, you know, things could get dicey if a super predator like a tiger shark comes through. And so you'll need to follow our directions exactly. And I said, okay, but we're wearing shark armor, right? And they said, yeah, I mean, we're wearing this like stainless steel chainmail, a very fine mesh chainmail that sharks can't bite through. And that was an insurance company requirement. So we said, well, we're wearing shark armor, right? And they said, yeah, but that stuff doesn't work. And we're like, what? And then they explain... And this is how I say to the audience. Then they explain that when a shark bites onto you, he'll attempt to separate your arm from your body, but with two methods. One is his teeth, and the shark armor will prevent those teeth from biting into you. But the other is he'll thrash back and forth.
Right.
And the fact is that whether or not you're wearing the shark armor, he will succeed in separating your arm from your body. The only thing the armor does is allow you to take the arm back home with you.
Well, and then at the end, Tony the Tiger Shark, it's great. You know, I find that when you ever come to the end of a story and you don't know how you want to end it, just go, and then I jerked off. It doesn't matter what the story is.
I don't know that's going to work with my crowd.
Well, I don't
know.
There's
a lot of children in the crowd.
Go, the shark gave me my arm back, and then I jerked off with it.
I called it the stranger.
Yeah, because it was like someone else's arm at that point. The shark did you a favor. Just kind of play with it from there and see how it goes.
Happy endings. Shark diving.
Mythbusters After Dark. Ending. You could do that. The Late Show gets a little blue.
After Dark. I've now got plenty of material for Mythbusters After Dark.
Well, you did. Was it the first time you did stand up on the podcast in 2010?
That was, was that long ago? Wow.
Yeah, that was like spring of 2010.
Criminy.
Yeah. You're like, well, I'm going to try stand up.
You were so sweet for letting me try
that. But you did great. But then you said, and then I saw you a few weeks later, and you're like, I think I understand the difference between performing for your audience and then just performing. Because I did a set in Vegas.
Oh my God, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. And more than that, my friend who's a showrunner for a big network show was there. And I mean, it was just, I wanted to go really well. And then afterwards, he took me out to dinner and he's like, look, you need to understand that you went dirty really fast. And that crowd, that's not your crowd, that's just a crowd.
They don't
know you're doing that.
They don't understand.
Yeah, and so then it was funny. I saw Craig Ferguson perform at the Symphony Hall in San Francisco, and he opens his show cursing like a sailor and talking about how he's going to curse like a sailor. And I realized, right, he's getting the audience used to that this is a different Craig.
Right.
He's layering in the...
Yeah. You know, usually the audience will follow you anywhere. You just have to... Sometimes just have to give the, you have to like clear the path a little bit. So you can do, you know, if, but in this instance, it's probably not appropriate. Like these audiences, especially, you know, if you're doing small, intimate, more alternative shows, you could totally get away with it. But you know, if these are like theaters with thousands of people, then it's going to be
lots of families and stuff.
Yeah. A lot of families and abroad.
Ends up being, The place I get to really spread my wings is when we have a super crazy enthusiastic crowd. With crowds like that, you can try everything. And you can sort of like let materials sort of expand and try different bits in there.
Yeah.
And that's where I get a lot of stuff. And then I'll go back to the room and I'll take some notes. They record the show off the board every night. So I'll listen
good.
To a little section here and there.
It's amazing. And then, you know, you might not even, you should, when you're done, you should listen to the first one and then the last one and then just
see. Oh, I had never considered that.
See how it evolves. Because you won't, sometimes you'll notice bits and pieces here and there.
Right.
But sometimes you don't really have a bird's eye view of how much it's evolved. So if you listen to one and the other, you're like, oh my God.
That's and awesome. That's totally going
to
be my
to
project.
To the point where the first one might almost be unlistenable to you. You're like, oh, what was I saying? You know, like, because you're just figuring it out.
Yeah.
How's Jamie doing on the road?
Jamie's doing great. You know, it's funny. He is so inexorably himself. It's not like he loves being on stage, not at all. But he loves the tour because it's ours.
Yeah.
It's just us. There's no one messing with us. We make all the calls. It's our baby.
Yeah.
And that's really satisfying. And frankly, on stage, about once a night, he'll knock some joke out of the park that just comes to him. And it's really lovely to watch him get like comfortable. First couple of nights, he might be a little bit rough, but frankly, once we're rolling, he's into it.
he's probably not a guy that ever thought to himself when he was younger, someday I'm going to perform in theaters
for thousands of
people.
We built a knife throwing gag into the show now, and so he gets to actually throw knives at Target on stage.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, it's really fun. We started to put in stuff of our skill level. So I have a juggling bit now because, I mean, I juggle a little and it has a history. And so I tell a story about the origin of my juggling.
And do you want to say that or do you want to save it for
the show? I'm going to save it for the show. Come on out. Come on out to the show. I know in LA no one goes out, but you should come out.
You should. Come on, Los Angeles. Be different from the normal Los Angeles.
I just got back from, I just got here from 100.3 where I did the My Turn thing. They allowed me to DJ 12 songs for an hour.
Oh, wow.
They're going to air it later in December.
So was it all Limp Bizkit songs or just...
all Joni Mitchell. I'm a sensitive lady.
Joni Mitchell, phenomenal. And it's been really interesting to hear her voice evolve over the years with the smoking.
I know. Now it's really
now it's really down there. And it started, you know, her voice was always so angelic. But even as it progressed, it was still good. Like, it's still good and listenable and cool, but...
You know, I was getting my kids into it. I wanted to show them. I wanted them to understand how Blue is like one of the greatest albums ever recorded. And I didn't realize that she's not playing a guitar when she sings California. She's playing a dulcimer, like a lap dulcimer. And she's literally like doo-doo-doo-doo. And it's virtuoso work she's doing. It's really amazing. There's YouTube videos all over.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, with like 21-year-old Joni Mitchell sweetly playing this dulcimer.
The first time I ever heard the original version of Woodstock is just because I know the sort of the grunge funk version that's Crosby, Stills, and then her version is way different. Her version really highlights the lyrics more. Like, it fits more with what the lyrics are.
That's
we
one of those
stardust. We are golden.
It is one of those cases where I think that the cover is better than the song.
I'm a big fan of like that, but it is interesting to hear, you know, and then just knowing their relationship and how it all.
Oh wait, I don't know that they had a relationship.
Yeah, wasn't she with Graham Nash, Joni Mitchell? Maybe. Katie. I thought they were. I thought Our House was about them.
Oh wow, I did not know that.
Let's find out. We're going to the internet. Katie Levine.
I love Crosby, Stills, Nash version of Woodstock.
It's so good.
I love the ha 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 at the end.
It says that, yeah, he lived with Joni Mitchell and her two cats on their house on Laurel Canyon.
They had to add cats to make her seem a little crazy.
Oh, wait. Just two cats, though.
Just two cats.
Yeah, old two cats Joni, they called her. Joni two cats Mitchell.
I love Laurel Canyon. That's where I would want to live if I came down here.
2 years they were together.
All right.
Yep. So I don't know if I got the timing right, but I at least knew that they were together. And the reason I know this is because my ex, Janet Varney, is... if you've never talked to her about Joni Mitchell, you guys will bond.
Oh, nice. She was at the thing on Saturday night.
Nice. At the Thrilling?
Yeah.
It's great. Janet plays and sings, and her voice is very...
I didn't know.
Very this. Early Joni Mitchell.
Oh, wow.
She has an amazing voice. I wish she would sing more, but I guess if I were really wishing for things, I guess world peace and then no more disease. And then at some point, like, I wish Janet would sing more.
Okay, so I'm reading this crazy great book.
What?
It's called Popular Crime.
Okay.
And it's by Bill James.
All right.
Who is the inventor of sabermetrics.
All right.
Like, he's the guy that came up with a whole new way of looking at baseball statistics that helped Billy Beane make the A's a World Series team that the movie Moneyball is based on. So I knew about Bill James because I'd read the, you know, profiles on him in magazines and stuff. But he also has this minor interest in popular crime stories going back hundreds of years and how they've affected society's look at crime and society in general.
And what's the result?
Well, he seems to be making a case that we look at prosecuting crimes in totally the wrong way. That we put all this weight on things like, and he was mean to his mother, you know, and they put all these sort of anecdotal stuff into trials. And he makes the case that there are more balanced ways of looking at evidence in order to come to a point system for convicting someone of a crime.
He's moneyballing crime?
Yes, he's trying to moneyball crime, which is kind of a great idea. But it's not like that's the thesis of the book, because he's also just really interested in crime stories like the Lindbergh baby case and the Black Dahlia murders. We just got to the Onion Fields in the book. And he talks about movies and books about them. He talks about the actual case. He reads every book about every case. So, you know, if it's something like the – you know, the Lindbergh baby, there's like 40 books and he's read them all and will tell you these 37 are shit, but these three are really good. And then he'll criticize and compliment the authors for various stuff. I mean, we just got to this in the book. He just went through this really interesting thing about Stroud, the Birdman of Alcatraz, who I didn't realize not only raised birds, but wrote books about the care of pet birds, that he established the industry of care for pet birds.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. Out of a prison cell.
So he's responsible for, like, Parakeet Magazine and, like, all those?
Bird Fancier. Yeah, he was. If you go back, he wrote the first texts on it. Now, he was also a really good writer, but a complete psychopath who openly fantasized about killing children the entire time he was in jail.
Oh, wow. I don't think I knew that.
I didn't know that either.
For some reason, I just pictured it was like kindly old man in a flawed justice system.
Exactly. And this is what James says, is that the Burt Lancaster depiction of him as a kindly old man, a victim of the justice system, is one of the things that caused the Miranda rulings to come into play and caused all of this rehabilitation effort that actually went almost too far in the 60s. Now, of course, starting in 1980, we've boomeranged all the way in the other direction, where it's like, just put them in solitary all day long and ignore them.
Right.
And he talks about how crime stories have led to our societal assumptions about what criminals are and what they're worth, and he's just analyzing it. It's really just riveting.
It reminds me of, Eastern State Penitentiary, maybe? In Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
Is that Eastern State?
Yeah.
Is that Eastern State Penitentiary?
It's
one that you can tour.
Yeah, that's the one.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, it goes back to the...
It's not inhabited.
No, okay. It's basically just a tourist destination now. But it's really interesting because you see the evolution of prison theory from the from the oldest part of the prison as they continued to build out. And the earliest part of the prison, it was almost like, it's almost like a monastery. And they would put criminals in there to essentially reflect and find God or whatever. And in these, and it was actually very, I mean, they were definitely isolated, but it was really beautiful. And it looked, you know, just like it looked like a monastery.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the years and over the decades, just how the cells and the condition changed and the socialization of prisoners changed and how the politics changed. And it and then you basically, if you tour it in order, you watch, you know, the essentially the demise of this system and how it just kind of ends up turning into like a prison yard free for all thing.
Right.
And then how they change their minds about no prisoners need to be socialized. They need this and that. And so it's if you're ever there, it's a really fascinating facility.
And where is this?
It's in Philadelphia.
Okay. I'll be in Williamsport next weekend. Okay. I'll be around there next weekend.
The two things you need to hit are that penitentiary and the Mütter Museum.
I've heard about the Mütter Museum. I'm totally down with heading over there. Is it specifically one collection of strange things, or is this the one that has the large Duchamp collection?
I only saw one giant collection of things, but maybe there are other collections of things. It's all like, you know, the man with the most impacted colon in the history of the world.
Oh, okay.
It's
the Mütter. Yeah. Paul Sorbonne. Paul and Storm was telling me I had to go to the Mütter Museum.
Yes. Paul, who lives in Philadelphia, will take you to the Mütter Museum and then also to really good Chinese food.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Excellent. I will go.
He knows how to do it upright.
I'm actually taking the train over there.
Oh.
From New York, because I'll be in New York the day before, and they were like, you want to fly? And our first show of the tour is in Williamsport, and Williamsport is 3 hours from everywhere.
Right.
It's hilarious. When you really look at it on Pennsylvania, you see, you can fly into Cleveland, you can fly into Pittsburgh, it's 3 hours. But there's a train that goes right from New York.
Take the train.
Oh, I love the train. Have you done extensive traveling on the train?
I've not done extensive train traveling. I have traveled via train before. Between Boston and New York, and then also between
Venice, Italy, and Paris via Switzerland.
Nice.
Which was a good one.
That sounds romantic. I hope you were with someone.
I was. I was. I was with Janet at the time. This was, I don't know, 2007 probably. But we got on this one old-timey train that reminded me of the old-timey train from Young Frankenstein, where the couple's arguing in English, and then they're on the old-timey train, and then they're arguing in, like, Romanian or German or whatever they're arguing in, the same exact argument. It reminded me of that. Like, that we got an old-timey train that reminded me of that.
We have – my wife and I have done trips from New York to Montreal, San Francisco to Seattle, and a few years ago we actually did San Francisco to Chicago, stopping for a few days in Aspen.
Oh,
I have a friend there who's a magician.
And he's just up in Aspen?
Yeah.
Is he the town magician?
He is. I guess he would be the town magician.
Yeah.
He spent well over a decade being the magic bartender at John Denver's bar in Aspen.
Wow.
Which, can you imagine the experience you get brewing magic for drunk people for like 12 years?
Oh my God.
I've never seen anyone who can hold a crowd and flirt with a whole crowd of people. Like, this guy's name is Eric Mead. He's amazing.
Aspen's really interesting because I'm not sure there's actually a middle class there. It's like the rich people and then the people who work for them. And those are the two demographics in Aspen.
Like Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah. It's fun. There used to be a great comedy festival in Aspen.
Is it not still there?
No, it hasn't been there for years.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
10 years.
Where is the big comedy festival now?
Well, they moved the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival to Vegas for a few years, and I don't know now. I'm not sure if it's still around.
There's one in Montreal, right?
Yeah, it's just for laughs. Juste pour rire.
That's where I saw my favorite episode of The Green Room. It was the episode with you. Is it you, Tim Minchin?
Jimmy Carr. Eddie Izzard, Judah Friedlander.
Oh my God, so good.
Those guys were fucking amazing.
That was incredible.
It was
fun. It was like watching big leaguers beat each other up with baseball bats.
That was so much fun. You know, we did that show and I had to fly out the next morning. I can't remember where I was. I was doing a show somewhere. But I had to fly out the next morning, and we did the green room, and ended up just hanging out with those guys. And I don't think I went to bed that night because
I wouldn't.
Eddie Izzard, I'd never met him, but it was the first time I met him, and so he went back to the main hotel in Montreal, which is like a Sheraton or something,
yeah,
where it's all the comics day, and then the lobby is essentially like the Laugh Olympics of comics.
Oh my gosh!
And so. Yeah, and so he was down there and then just ended up just hanging out and talking to him and listening and then hanging out with other comics until I was like, well, I got to go. And I went upstairs and got my suitcase and got on a plane. That was a really fun festival that year.
Oh, I can imagine. I had dinner with Tim just the other night.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, he's living here now.
Yeah, Minchin, yeah, yeah. He is. I think he's doing – I think I'm doing a show with him Friday night.
Oh, nice.
At Largo.
Oh, with Sarah Silverman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's nice. It's nice to see, you know, when – you know, we all just sort of a lot of times meet in passing Those festivals are so great because it's really the time where you get quality time with comics that you like and respect and that you never really just get to see, despite the fact that a lot of us live in the same city.
Right. So I just had this really cool thing come up. The AV Club is doing asked for an article from me about my dad because they're celebrating one of the anniversaries of Sesame Street.
Mm-hmm. It's 45th.
45th?
Mm-hmm.
45th. So my father did a bunch of the early animations on Sesame Street, really back in like 1970, 71, and raised us making money by doing two or three animations a year.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
Wow.
And
which ones did he do? Do you remember any of the famous ones?
Yeah, and so I covered a bunch of them in the article. He did one about Harry likes to hit a construction worker named Harry. Harry likes to work high in the sky. In fact, for his lunch, Harry likes to climb to the highest spot in the building. And so the whole animation is just following Harry as he goes higher and higher and higher and higher. And he gets all the way to the top. And some guy yells, Harry, you forgot your lunch. It's just like my dad's sense of humor. But in the article, I point out that later on, when I was 11 or 12, my dad hired me to do the voice for a character named Heathcliff, which was part of a series of 10 animations that they hired him to do of a boy and a girl trying to figure out how something works, Heathcliff and Sheila, he and she.
Yeah.
And they have ridiculous ideas of how something works, like a faucet. And then this creature named It shows up and tells them how it really works. And I haven't seen any of these in 30 years. And someone in the comments section on the AV Club, I know I shouldn't have been there reading, but someone in the comments section.
You know better. What are you doing? You know better.
Someone
the one
posted-
thing you can't fix, Adam. No matter how many machines you have.
Somebody found one of those animations, and it's on YouTube. So I immediately tweeted a link to it, and I played for my wife in the car on the way here to hear my 12-year-old voice.
That's incredible. And how ironic that it was about figuring out how something
works. I know. I was like, Julia was like, so you were myth-busting at 12 years old.
That's incredible. And then you just ended up expressing that in your adult life.
I know. It hadn't even occurred to me that that was the subject of those.
That's so fantastic. I mean, that's when the internet works the way it should work. The internet works for good.
My father paid me $5 for each one of those I did. Each one of the things I did the voice for. And then when we did He, She, and It, I was doing 10 in a row. And so I was like, do I get $50? This is 1977. I'm 12 years old.
Yeah.
That's a
you could buy a Skylark with that money.
Yeah, man. And he's like, slow down, cowboy. And instead I got the Book of Lists too. Which turns out both me and Hodgman... Both Hodgman and I received the Book of Lists too as young preteens and read it from cover to cover multiple times.
And probably knew all the lists.
Memorized all. We had so much to go over when we realized.
God, those were so popular. The Book of Lists and then the Guinness books and all of them. I was fascinated by that stuff too.
And the Book of Lists was the Wallaces and the Wallachinskis, the writers of the People's Almanac.
Mm-hmm.
It's just riveting, you know? It was like 14 people whose bank robberies went awry.
It's basically BuzzFeed.
Right. It's exactly what it is, proto-BuzzFeed.
Yeah, yeah.
So I passed by a store here in L.A. yesterday that said BuzzFeed on the outside. Is that mm-hmm. where they are?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, they have a couple buildings.
Can you go buy lists?
I don't... 5 things you can buy in a BuzzFeed store. Not a list. Ironically, yeah. BuzzFeed, they're doing really well. They've expanded quite a bit here in Los Angeles. But are you so? I'm sorry if I don't know the answer to this.
I know it's.
Is MythBusters still going?
Yeah,
you're still on.
We're still on. We just finished. So you know that Cary Grant and Tori are no longer on the show.
Yes. Was that okay?
That's okay. We didn't want that to happen. That was sad. Very sad.
I adore all of them
so much.
They're
all so awesome.
I saw Tori at the Emmys. I see Grant because we're in a friend group.
Yeah, and he's down here now.
And he's down here, yeah. And Carrie I never see, but she's always so sweet whenever I see her.
She's awesome. So we filmed the show without them this year, since January.
Was it strange? Did it just feel like all...
It's strange and it's weird and it's like twice the work, right? Because we're telling the whole story. No, they were producing 45 or 50% of every episode, and now we're doing 100%. And that required a whole sort of shift in how the show looks and how the show feels because it's a structurally different show now. And I'm really happy with where we got to with it. It's a ton more process. There's a lot more behind-the-scenes screw-ups and a lot more kind of the trial and error of what it takes to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
And we replaced a lot of our GoPros with this camera called a Blackmagic, which is, you might know, it's just cinematic quality, little tiny camera, costs about $1,000. And so we have, I think, 4 of them. And so the show has a much more – oh, and instead of the infinite focus of the GoPro lens, you could put prime lenses on these and get a very cinematic look, like a shallow depth of field mm-hmm. where this is in focus and that's not. So the look of the show is really gorgeous. And they're going to start airing early next year. I don't know the exact dates yet, but I think January, February. And I'm really excited to see how they do. We just – like I said, we finished 3 weeks ago, and I'm not sure when we're starting up again. It's – again, early in the year, but we're now at something like 270 hours we've made over the last 12 years.
Jesus. Is it, I mean, when you start gearing up for a new season, are you like, what the fuck else are we going to do?
No, you know, the thing that I've learned to love the thing that I didn't realize was my job is the storytelling. The building and the experimental design and all of that is ancillary to the fact that you're telling a story from beginning to end. And right. that narrative process of figuring out how that story goes and where the chunks fit. And also realizing that there's portions of the story that the editors are going to see that you don't. Mm-hmm. So we're just sending them footage. So they're going to get all this footage and they're going to see. So you want to give them all the options and think that process of thinking through how does this sequence fit to that? And how can I give the editors the ability to put this one before that if it works?
Mm-hmm.
Or we might do an experiment and we know that after that experiment, depending on the result, we might do one of four things.
Oh, in-brain editing is a pain in the ass.
Right. And we want to give the editors the ability to do any one of those. So then we'll talk to the camera and say, okay, hey, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to record this piece, but I'm going to record it three different ways depending on the results that we're going to get. Good luck.
Oh, my God.
I love that process. Like, that to me is so satisfying and so much fun. And we have some fun guest stars. We got Jonathan Banks.
Yes.
Who plays Mike on Breaking Bad. He came on the show. We had no idea what to expect with him. Have you met him?
Oh, yeah. He's a lovely man.
He's a sweetie pie.
Yeah.
I he showed up and everyone was a little bit nervous.
No, he was, you know, because he's always played a tough guy or a bad guy or a guy.
I remember him from Beverly Hills Cop.
And he, on the last, when we did our last episode of the Breaking Bad after show, he was like,
oh, I'm sorry, I'm an idiot. Of course
he was very misty. He was very, it's okay, we're even. I was like, his Mythbusters don't make me. It's not that I don't love you and the show. I just, you know how you just get behind.
There's a lot of things going on.
There's a lot of things going on. And, you know, gotta carve out that catch up time on everything. I keep saying to myself, like, I'm going to take a catch up vacation where I just catch up on everything that I've fallen.
Bill Gates apparently takes 2 weeks a year to read all the books.
Sure.
That he's got on his list.
It's 2 weeks. Yeah. To read those books.
There was a New York article about his philanthropy, and it only serves to increase your feeling that Bill is smarter than all of us. Early on, when he decided he wanted to give a ton of his money away, he reached out to this one guy who's an expert at philanthropy and said, what can I do with my money to make it useful? Because you can't just give money away. You need to be smart about where it goes
Not political rules as much, although there can be, but also social rules. Like, you can't just give a country like $100 million and be like, good luck. Like, there needs to be infrastructure. Like, someone has to know how to deal with the money. Yeah. They have to allocate it properly.
And you have to teach them how to spend more money. You might take an organization that could sorely use money, but giving them $10 million is just going to cripple them because they don't know what to do with it. And so you want to be able to help them spend it.
Which is crazy because anyone who's ever won the lottery ends up really happy. And then all their problems are fixed.
Exactly.
So...
So he went to this expert, and the expert who has talked to many billionaires was like, okay, here's a list of the 23 books you should read if you really want to give away billions of dollars. I'll see you later. And 7 months later, he runs into Bill at this other conference, probably like Davros or something like that. And Bill's like, okay, I've only had the opportunity to read 16 of the 23 books, but here's where I've come to.
Really? I just made up like 10 of those. I didn't feel like talking to you.
Amelia Bedelia didn't need to be read for philanthropy.
Seriously, does Horton need to hear a who? That was a joke, Bill. Glad you got through it.
I once,
Breaking Dawn. You really didn't see it when I gave you Breaking Dawn. Well, I just thought that the political structure between the struggles between the vampires and the werewolves. No, Bill, please.
Oh, that's Breaking Dawn.
Yeah. What do you think it was?
I was thinking of the Rescue Dawn. I was thinking of the Werner Herzog film.
Okay. Yeah, that was a much smarter reference. Referencing Twilight, Adam.
That's the name of the vampire, right?
Yeah, that's the name of the vampire. Good callback. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I once had dinner with an experimental psychologist whose specialty was lottery winners, which in Britain, they really get screwed because you get the full sum right away, tax-free.
Oh.
Like, you win the Irish sweepstakes, $20 million bucks. They give you $20 million bucks, bang.
Wow. Oh, that's fascinating. What did he say?
Not a single one of them's lives wasn't ruined by winning the lottery. Not just not happy. Their lives were ruined by winning the lottery.
So what are some of the factors involved besides? Because I can guess, like, it completely changed the social dynamic of your family. And
that's the primary one. I mean, he had one where a guy won $20 million and he gave like six of his family members $1 million each and they all stopped speaking to him.
Ugh.
Now, I know that there's more to that story.
Sure.
Right? Like, there has to be layers and layers and layers. But yeah, the social dynamic thing and being able to navigate it is really difficult.
And also knowing how to, you know, I remember I was in a car accident when I was 17 years old and I got a settlement of like $30,000, which, and I was broke at the time. And so $30,000 might as well have been billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so what followed was, you know, I think I got the money in March and then I just didn't really worry. I was like, oh, I'll just buy stuff. I'll just buy, because it's very empowering to just go buy whatever I want. Yes. It's like a genie and it's never ending. And by November, I was like, where'd all the money go? Like, I had just blown through all of it, and that was supposed to get me through, you know. It was not a responsible good lesson, but it was not a responsible couple of months.
There was an article recently about a British garbage worker who won $10 million or some multiple millions, which he spent a year spending on cars and hookers.
Wow.
And at the end of the year, the cars were repossessed. And he was back to being a garbage man. He was like, no, it was cool. I had a good time.
It's cool. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and then all of the, you know, and then with, you know, with the prostitutes, you're not getting receipts and you can't get reimbursed for that. It's like, it's not, you know.
Could you, what?
It's a hard good and then a soft good for 7 minutes and then a hard good again.
I will state that I'm probably God. Getting multiple.
A second ago, you were referencing Werner Herzog and now making boner jokes.
Boner jokes are where it all begins.
You know how it is. I've known you a long time. You know where this goes.
Actually, now that my boys are 15, twin boys, making boner jokes is one of the fastest ways to stop them from messing with me. Because it's so awful for them to hear the
words.
Their dad
would say.
The time you were at Woodstock at Founders Night last year, they were backstage. And I went out and did, you know, 20 minutes. And I came backstage and they were like, too many penis jokes. Don't ever do that to us again. And a few nights ago, I make them turn in all their porn delivery devices. All electronics go to my office at the end of every day.
Sure.
So it's 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. They've returned them. And now they're standing at the top of the stairs and we're sort of shooting the breeze. You know, I'm standing at the door to my bedroom and they're not going to bed. I'm like, no, it's time to go to bed. And they're sort of being charming the way that kids can be late at night. And they're like, I know, we don't have to. We can still talk about stuff. And then we start talking about a movie and it's still going. And I'm like, okay, now it's time to go to bed. And because I'm standing there with my hands on my hips like this, Julia, my wife, she slips her hands under my arms and we start doing the routine where her arms are mine. So I start
like
saying,
helping hands improv.
Yeah. So I say, look, there's three reasons you need to go to. She's doing it all great. Yeah. I said, hold on, I got to pick my nose. And she jams her pinky into my nose. Doesn't help. Doesn't. They're like, yeah, that's not going to make us go. And then I go, wait a minute, I got to scratch my nuts. And she reaches down. And they broke the speed of sound getting to their bedrooms.
Parental warfare. That's amazing.
That was the nuclear option.
Thing one and thing two?
Yep.
Are they still thing one and thing two?
They are still thing one and they both have girlfriends now.
What?
It's totally fascinating territory to navigate as a parent.
Are they dating other twins?
No. Okay. No. It's not an episode of Happy Days.
Okay, great.
The Fonz. They both have girlfriends and they're lovely, wonderful girls. And, you know, we know their families because obviously we're all in communication because these are teenagers and it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know how much I want to go into it, but
no, you don't have to go.
It's totally amazing.
Just as long as you let the boys know, they're smarter than we are. Be careful.
Julia's wonderful insight into it was, we're thinking, how do we approach, you know, it's our son and their daughter, right? So that's somebody's daughter. And Julia said, we have to think like her parents, not like his.
Oh.
And I was like, that's brilliant. That's the exact right way to approach all of the problem solving with this equation.
Yeah. Well, listen, if the family comes over for dinner, you got to do the nut scratching gag again just to see how it flies. When if like dinner's over and they're not leaving,
exactly,
you got to do the
that'll go over really well. Go,
guys, before we have dessert,
we want to show you.
Oh, look at this! I'm gonna make a cake.
We can do a magic trick where we pull the figs from dessert out of my zipper. That'll be awesome. And the kids, oh my God, could you imagine?
Oh, they'd be scarred temporarily.
My friend Sarah Bunting, who writes for Tomato Nation, that's her website. Yep. She said that she walked in on her parents having sex when she was 19.
Oh.
And she said that was far worse than being 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Because they were.
Then you know what it is.
At 19, your parents are, as far as you're concerned, old. And she was like, mom was on top.
Oh.
It was gross.
Oh.
I'm not sure I'm supposed to tell that story, but there it is.
That's a good story. I thought there would be a tomato involved.
Mom, what are you doing? This is a reverse cowgirl, sweetie.
That's really funny. There's no, you know, that's almost kind of where you're like, just let them learn about it on the internet. Rather than
Google everything.
Just don't walk in on the, I mean, you know, it's not fair. I mean, it's good that it grosses us out because it's our parents, but it's also not fair that we don't allow until we're much older the idea that our parents are just human beings.
Right.
Just a couple of people that had sex at some point. And then you all of a sudden were tugging at their sleeve, and then, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, with my grandparents, it was inconceivable.
Right.
That they ever conceived. That it was inconceivable, even to my mom, their daughter. It's totally, you have no idea. My grandfather, picture Max von Sydow with no charm. That was my grandfather. And my grandmother was like Barbara Bush. Right, I mean, it was.
Well, yeah, because they didn't have waxing back then. Oh, were you? Oh, you weren't making a. I'm sorry. I thought you were.
My grandmother waxing joke.
Nice.
She was not Brazilian. How many's a Brazilian again?
Yeah. So she had the grandma toe.
Yeah.
Come on, guys. We're having fun. They're just jokes.
Excellent. Excellent.
So the Mythbusters find the Mythbusters.
Our show at the Nokia will be a very family-oriented show. With nary a curse in the evening.
Not one.
Not a single one.
So how long is the show and what's the structure of the show?
It's effectively a two-hour sort of variety show. I don't want to... It's a difficult show to describe because many of the ways you would normally describe it would make a certain swath of people stay away, mm-hmm. thinking, oh, this is family entertainment. And it is, but it's sort of like we ascribe to the Bugs Bunny humor level of playing it on multiple levels.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the show, on Mythbusters, the TV show, we really genuinely don't know what the outcome of most of our experiments are going to be. Like, we're just as mystified as the audience might be, or perhaps more so. But you can't take that to a stage and say, hey, watch while something might not happen.
Right.
So when we first started writing it, we knew that we wanted to build these set pieces to talk about certain concepts, but we put it under the aegis of thinking that from a scientific standpoint, how you look at something, your vantage point means everything. And that's... If you have two vantage points, you're going to have a better ability to sort of take something apart. And so we play around with the audience's perception of things, sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively. But, I mean, towards the end of Act One, we bolt a camera to someone's head and make them see the world in our way and then make them run an obstacle course. And
oh, that's cool.
Really, really – I mean, for us, it's all like, I want to try that. Yeah. So I put a camera on my head, and when I figured out the coolest thing to do, we put that on the stage. And on Friday, Jamie and I are getting together at M5 to redo it, because we, like, every time we take it out, we want to modify and play with stuff. So this time we're doing some really radical stuff with the camera.
So it's a full-on, like, there's stuff.
There's a bunch of stuff.
It's not just you guys on stage talking.
Oh, no. I early on in the show, I bring up the smallest kid I can find in the audience, and I pit him against the largest dude I can find in the audience. And with a little physics, the kid always wins, and it's really, really fun. We've got some violence in there. We've got a huge – we have a huge finale, which involves some shooting.
Great.
We take the audience both on a tour of – sort of our understanding of how we came to these jobs in science. And we also have a bit of Q&A in there because we love doing that.
Yeah.
There's nothing more fun to me than talking to an audience that's interested in what you're doing and getting really sort of interesting questions.
It's a special part of the show, and it's part of the show that's very intimate for that particular group.
Yeah.
And it relates to them, and you're interacting with them, and it's a good part of the show.
Yeah, and Jamie really definitely loves that part of the show. He likes talking to the crowd. He actually likes going out into the crowd, and it's very fun when you walk out into the crowd and
Volare.
It starts. Get up on the tablecloth.
Cantare. I would love it if Jamie just broke into fucking like a standard song.
I wish I could get him to sing for something.
One time.
It would be so good.
I'm telling you, like, it would be like a fucking applause break in your show if no one ever saw it coming, and then he just broke into song, and then, like, you freeze, spotlight on Heinemann, and he just, like, goes out into the audience and serenades someone. I mean,
you know, whenever we have a birthday on the Mythbusters crew, of course, we always surprise them with a cake and we all sing happy birthday. And the joke I tell every single time without fail is, happy birthday, dear Carrie. And then I go, sing it, Jamie.
Nothing.
Nothing. Always a laugh because it's just so ludicrous to imagine him singing. I even at one point, I think I wrote a sketch for us where I had him speak singing.
Mm-hmm.
Like Heartbreak Hotel, because that's what the Fonz did. Remember that?
Yes,
the Fonz wasn't comfortable with singing, so he spoke.
He
some.
Spoke his part. Yeah,
yeah.
And Jamie's sort of like the Fonz.
He's a little bit like the Fonz in the degree to which the Fonz didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Right.
Aww.
I missed a photograph the other night. I was driving here in LA past this large martial arts studio, and the second T in martial arts was missing, or the light was out, so it said martial arts. And I was literally trying to take a picture that this is where pirates learn to fight.
It's like martial arts. Karate.
Karate. We did a epic Captain's Wife's Lament at Comic-Con this year.
Oh, last, you did it! You beat?
No, we didn't beat Chicago.
No, not Chicago. We did one in San Francisco.
Was that the one that was like almost 50 minutes long?
It was like almost an hour.
We didn't beat that, but we came within like 4 minutes of it. And then the venue was literally like, "We're gonna just turn the switch off."
Get your pirate shit out of here, please. We have to go home.
How was Comic-Con for you this year? I didn't see one bit of
I
you.
I know you had your thing, and I wasn't able to go. It's Comic-Con for me is, this year was actually, it was insanely busy, but less insanely busy than the year before. The year before,
Grammel-toe. I got super excited. I'm sorry, Grammel-toe.
No, please, just came please. Back. No, I appreciate that. Yeah, it'll keep sneaking up on you like a butterscotch candy. Comic-Con, I took, I don't know, maybe six less panels moderating this year than the previous year. So, you know, it wasn't as – like I had time to eat at Comic-Con this year.
Oh, man. It's like an 18-hour slog.
But it's
day.
An onslaught because it's, you know, panels all day, interviews all day. And then we did At Midnight one night, and then we did podcasts the next night. And it just – you know, I wasn't able to go till Thursday because we shoot At Midnight on Wednesday.
Right,
and
right.
So – and Sunday more panels, and then had to get back to work because I had to work on Monday. So it was just a – Comic-Con is, it's work, 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 but it's fun work.
Oh, I know,
I
know.
I always look forward to it.
It's like I get to bed at two or three in the morning and up at 7:30 in the morning every day.
Yeah, but I just don't have a lot of hangout time at Comic-Con anymore, which, you know, I'm not complaining about it.
I just remember that time a few years ago when you and Felicia ran through the con on Sunday. It was like practically empty.
Yeah. This for San Diego, practically.
Yeah, San Diego. You guys, it was like the last day, and you guys were just like, screw it, let's go through.
Ran through real fast. Yeah, I know. It's fun, though. And then I remember, I think, the first time we hung out at Comic-Con, you and Julia were laughing about something, and your heads came together.
Oh, no. You know what it was? And I don't feel like repeating it right here, but you told us the Bob Saget joke.
Oh, right.
He told us the joke that loses his audience every time he tells it. And
yeah, like, yeah, Chris, yeah. And I've told the joke on the podcast before when Bob was on. It was a joke that I begged to tell on stage once, and it grossed people out. But I still thought it was so funny, which is I had a tattoo on my mom's face put on my butt because it was the only thing that kept my dad from fucking me in the ass.
And the moment he said that to Julia, my wife and I, we laughed so hard, we both went down and clapped our heads together.
I heard the sound of your heads colliding, trying to occupy the same space.
Is there any better metric that we were born for each other?
Yes, and it was now that you guys are both okay, I can say, but it was the mixture of you're in pain, but it's like, like you're oscillating back and forth between those two states.
I know. And then about 3 weeks after that, we were staying at the Mandarin in New York, and we saw him get off the elevator, and Julia was like, it's him! She's like, that's him! And I was like, oh my gosh, I can go say I know Chris, and we could probably say hi. And then the elevator closed, and we didn't get around to it.
When it was closing, we were like, do you have a tattoo on my face? Who's that motherfucking ass? Like, he was trying to get out, and everyone's like...
Yeah, exactly. That probably would go over really well.
It would go really well, yeah. No, but hopefully we'll get to, you know, I mean, we sort of always, are you in San Francisco? No, I'm not. I'm working. Are you in LA? I'm out of town. Like, we just.
And then, yeah, at Comic-Con, your people and my people were like, can he come do, and we can try.
So back
and,
it's
like
so
defusing
crazy.
A bomb.
I know, but the intention is always there to hang out.
Well,
so.
That's the best part about Comic-Con is one, having it be a locus of people that you want to see that you don't see very often, but two, is also like all just the crazy, like backstage about to go out into a panel, the green room.
Yeah.
So awesome.
It is. Just like it's.
I got to introduce Vince Gilligan and Patton Oswalt, watch the two of them meet.
Kind
of
nerd out on each other. Yeah.
But they had reached out to Patton to play a role on Breaking Bad at one point. And
yeah. Patton was like, I won't do this filth.
Yeah. Screw you, Gilligan.
I have morals. No, I'm actually, because Vince is a huge comedy fan and Patton is a fan of amazing things. So it is fun to watch people connecting
the worlds colliding.
That you don't, and watching A-list people nerd out over other A-list people is funny. It's totally. Funny because it just. It's very humanizing back there. And you're like, oh, they're just fucking people. They like shit, you know?
Well, so 2 years ago, I took Thing 2 to the EW party. Julia was like, I'm tired. Just take the boy. He'll have a really good time. So as we're about to go in, I go, so here's the thing you need to know. It's going to freak you out how many people you're going to see in here that you, like, can't believe are in one place.
Right.
Everyone in the party is just as freaked out. Mm-hmm. That's the one. The other thing is that normally celebrities try not to make eye contact with people in public, right? There's just, it's not like it's you try and avoid it, but you try not to encourage it because it's just it. You can feel sort of claustrophobic because a lot of people are looking at you, especially the A-listers at these parties. But at the party, it's pre-filtered, so everyone's looking around to see who else is there.
Right.
So go ahead and go up to people and say, can I take a picture? And Thing 2 met the cast of Workaholics.
Oh.
Which is, you've met them?
I know them. They're great.
Being around them is exactly like watching an episode of Workaholics.
They're terrific.
So Blaine, he goes, my son said, hey, there's these glowing balls in the pool, but they're hard plastic. They're not soft. And my son had just touched one and figured that out. And he said that to Blaine, and Blaine says, do you want me to get it for you? Do you want me to get it for you? Would you like me to get it for you? Because the previous year, Blaine had swum in the pool and gotten thrown out of the party and then brought back in. And Blaine then goes and grabs the glowing ball out of the pool and carries it around and gets like hundreds of people to sign it all evening long. Aww. And at the end, he comes over to Thing 2 and he goes, I need you to sign it because you made me get this.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It was amazing.
He just went in the pool in his clothes?
What's that?
He just went in the pool in his clothes?
No, no, no. He actually somehow grabbed a chair and used
and pulled
it,
to pull it in.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he just jumped in.
I wish.
That would have been a good story if he had just jumped in the pool. That was a very sweet story, but it would have been an epic story if he had gone in. That was the story. Here's the story.
Okay.
Here's the story, Adam. And then Blaine jumps in the pool in the middle of the party. He jumps out of the pool. Everyone signs it, and then I jerked off. And then you spike the microphone, you leave. That's how that works.
All right.
You know, I feel bad. I always feel like I feel like I drag down the level to, you know, to 15-year-old level.
I'm okay with that.
Humor-wise, but I know you are.
That's where I am on a normal
day. On a normal level. Yeah, this is what it's like when we're actually hanging out.
Oh, it's much worse than this. It's far worse than this.
I just don't want people to think that I'm all of a sudden like hip-checking you into filth town.
No, 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 no. I know. It's a funny thing, right? Because I am, I'm pitching, what do you call it, stumping for the tour that we're doing. And I want people to know about it, but it's, and this is the way that I talk, but of course, because I'm thinking, oh, well, families listen to this. No, no, no. I'm not going to be talking about cocksucking on stage on the Behind the Myths tour.
But we're going to prove that it's a myth.
I don't think it's a pejorative, personally. I don't know why it's a pejorative.
I don't either. Let's be okay with it.
I think we should.
As a culture.
Absolutely. There's no reason to think that it's something to be denigrated.
Stamp of approval.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm hope that I can come see the show. That's a nice theater.
Oh, man, it's wonderful, wonderful place. Nokia Theater, December 17th.
Yeah.
And afterwards, we'll have a little gathering nearby.
I would love to
join. So even if you can't come to the show, come to the gathering.
Good, I'm glad, because I started to invite myself, and then I was like, what if he was like, and we're having a gathering afterwards with some of the... Oh,
no, I'm actually... I know everyone in L.A. is really busy, so I'm sending out an invite, both comps for the show, but also where the party is afterwards. So
good. Good.
You can pick and choose.
I would love to. Well, please tell Jamie that I said hello.
I will.
And
he'll say, who's Chris?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. And you'll have to remind him. And like, well, all right. And then hopefully he'll break into song.
He's on that Philo T. Farnsworth device you watch in the evenings, Jamie.
And continued success and science. I'd love to hear the I'm actually interested to hear at the end of your tour. Just, I mean, off podcast, or if you want to talk about it in a recorded fashion, we can do that too. But I just want to hear your journey and like just how the bits all played out.
I will. And I love the idea of listening to the first and the last. I keep all the recordings.
Yeah.
I have about 80 now. But I don't listen to much of them, except I want to fix a part. But now that you said that, I am going to do that. I love that as an exercise.
It's really interesting. It's interesting to see because it's just hard to track your own growth as it's happening.
Yeah.
Or just to see how things evolve. And, you know, if you add one little thing every show after 100 shows, all of a sudden it's this incredible...
Well, that's what happens. At the end of a month, the show feels polished and really, really lovely.
And
in a different
you're like,
way.
I figured it out. And they're like, tour's done. You're like, fuck. I wanted to do this version for 30
Not to say that the early shows won't be great.
Not at all.
Not at all. Let's be clear.
Okay, shows 1 to 4. No, I'm kidding. No, but it's not that they're better or worse necessarily. It's just that it evolves. Like, it just changes.
Well, and you find different things. Like, you have to keep it fresh, so you change things up all the time.
Yeah. Well, it's good to see you, Adam.
Thanks
Savage.
For having me on.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. And the end.
And then I jerked off.
Hey!
Yeah! That was a white boy high five at the top of the mics.
No, that was jerking off. That's how fast I am.
One spank.
Done. One and done. Oh, just out of curiosity, if people want information, where should they go for the...
Oh, MythbustersTour.com.
MythbustersTour.com. We'll put that in the intro.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll put that.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.